Hello, it's Tuesday, April 4th, and you're listening to Wing Radio. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing Radio, which can be found at www.wingtv.net. Today we have an author who edited a book called Forbidden History. His name is J. Douglas Kenyon. And as I was telling Lisa while reading this book, this is probably the best book I've read in the last 2 or 3 years, and I read a lot of books, and I was just absolutely absorbed by what's in this. And what it is an anthology of prehistoric technologies and also the suppressed origins of civilizations. And the editor, Doug Kenyon, is also the editor of Atlantis Rising, a magazine that I've read many times in my life. So we'd like to bring on today Mr. J. Douglas Kenyon. Welcome to Wing TV. How are you doing, Doug?
Hello.
Well, good. How are you?
Real good. And, Doug, I wasn't exaggerating when I was saying how great I found this book to be. So before we start asking you some questions, tell everybody how they can find Forbidden History and also how they can find your magazine, Atlantis Rising.
Well, Forbidden History should be available in most major bookstores. I know it's in all the chains. It's published by Inner Traditions. And if you have any trouble finding it, just check on, you know, Inner Traditions. And it is listed with my name as the author.
Okay.
Kenyon. There are a lot of authors in the book, but and I authored about a quarter of the articles, but that's pretty much it. And as far as Atlantis Rising is concerned, that's also available in most newsstands, certainly in the big chains, Barnes & Noble, etc. And our website is AtlantisRising.com, and that should get just about anybody on the way to get in touch with us.
All right, and also, if anyone goes to the Wing TV homepage and hits the bookstore, we're now carrying this book also. And, Doug, as I told you right before we started the interview, we're only going to be able to hit the tip of the iceberg when it comes to this book. There's just so much in it. But I'd like to first ask you about the pyramids. And there's an author named Christopher Dunn who says that the Great Pyramid was actually a power plant. And when you think of all the other great things about the pyramids and the different uses, this is a very practical use that you would think an advanced civilization would need. They would need some kind of power. So tell everybody what Christopher Dunn had to write about the pyramid being a power plant.
Well, the important thing to know about Chris Dunn is he's an engineer and he's a tool designer. In fact, he's works in that capacity right now in Danville, Illinois. And Chris has been fascinated by the ancient Egyptian artifacts, and initially he was very interested in the fact that they exhibited the hallmarks of advanced technology just in terms of the precision with which they are made. And he's talking about things like, for example, smoothness. If you look at many of the granite surfaces in ancient Egypt, they're incredibly smooth. And so he measured this using modern engineering tools to understand exactly what the tolerance was, and verified that the smoothness was such that it's really hard to understand how it could possibly have been achieved without the tools that we have today. We use things like ultrasound and many other advanced technologies to achieve this level of smoothness. And an important thing to understand is nobody goes to that much trouble to get that kind of smoothness unless there's a reason.
Right, right.
Unless there's something that requires that tremendous effort. For example, in our engines in automobiles, the surfaces in the cylinders have that level of smoothness. And we know very well we have to do that for the engine to work properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, he followed along his ideas and did a lot of research on the pyramids, and it basically the idea that came to him was that, you know, the pyramid makes sense more as a machine than anything else.
Right.
It doesn't really, it's hard to understand it in many of the other theories that are offered for its explanation, certainly the idea that it was a tomb, for example.
Yeah.
It's a little hard to understand considering its massive scale. And the lack of ornamentation and the lack of hieroglyphs and the lack of all of the other hallmarks that we normally associate with tombs. And believe me, I'm just touching the surface of all of this.
Right.
He did a great deal of investigation, a great deal of resonating with the Earth itself.
Wow.
And therefore, and it's amplifying this and focusing it in some way that's not totally clear, but there was something of the sort involved. And when you factor in the fact that the pyramid is located at the center of the geographical surface of the planet, it really is, there are many other factors that you might call them just coincidences or maybe something that is an anomaly without an explanation, but in fact there's so many of these factors that it's hard to understand it in any other way once you've looked into it.
Okay. Let me ask you this.
You know, I think that, you know, you know the old story of the seven blind men and the elephant?
No.
It's a classic tale from, it's actually in many, Kipling actually, I think, wrote up a version of it, but I may be mistaken on that. But at any rate, the idea is that seven blind men come in contact with an elephant, and they all try to describe the elephant in terms they understand. And one falls against its side and says, ah, the elephant is like a wall. One gets hold of his trunk and says, nah, the elephant is like a snake. And one gets hold of its tail and says, no, the elephant is like a rope, etc. And so the idea is that everybody looks at something that's too big, too broad, too deep to understand, and tries to come up with metaphors or something that can classify what they're running into in terms that they understand. But in fact, not all of us are just looking at the central phenomenon from different angles and just getting that tip of the iceberg, to use your metaphor there.
Yeah.
You know,
and,
you grabbed me, Doug, you grabbed me with your introduction, where you say that psychiatrists apply the term post-traumatic stress syndrome to a group of mental disorders known to follow the witnessing of life-threatening events. You include some of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress syndrome, and you pose this question, which was very interesting. Could such a diagnosis be applied to the culture of an entire planet? So I'd like you to address for me quickly, if you could, the unwillingness to explore further and more accurately define man's beginnings and the ongoing and systematic repression of this research that runs counter to the entrenched belief systems.
Well, this is an idea that's been put forward by a number of people, most prominent among them, Emmanuel Velikovsky, who we quote quite a bit in the book, and we talk about what he had to say. But Velikovsky was a psychoanalyst, as well as a scientist who did a lot of analysis of ancient evidence and came up with some very controversial conclusions. But anyway, in a nutshell, the idea is that after thousands of years ago, we went through any number of cataclysmic events, and that the result of that was that we were scarred, deeply scarred, in such a way that the record of whatever it was we had experienced previously has been pretty much suppressed. And it's not something that just occurs on an individual level in situations like post-traumatic stress syndrome, where people block out a traumatic experience on an individual basis. But as time, when something is so global and so extensive in its implications, the institutions of society actually over time come to reflect this unconscious desire that for the good of all, certain memories remain forgotten, that certain doors stay closed. In some ways, this is a function of the healing process, but it can get locked in, and over a long period of time, certainly you forget.
Well, we've been persuaded
so
to forget.
That you can't reconstruct it.
We've been persuaded to forget, haven't we?
Yeah, I think so. The institutions are reinforcing this collective wish. It's an individual. I think that at one time, or at least it's the wish on the part of certain individuals who are in power, say, to to keep the, you know, their power depends upon the acceptance of certain assumptions about the nature of reality.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most important concepts in this entire book, and it lays a good foundation, which leads into then, Doug, this dichotomy between gradualism versus catastrophism in regard to earth changes. Touch upon right. that for a few minutes.
Okay, well, that's certainly a big subject, but Darwin, in his explanation and trying to explain the changes that have occurred, as that the evidence seems to indicate are present throughout our past, he did not want to the intention, you know, 150 years ago when these ideas were coming up, was basically to get rid of the religious explanations which had been out there prevailing before that, and they wanted to explain and understand things. There was to find another mechanism by which they could understand the changes that had occurred in the past, and basically they came up with the idea that changes occur gradually over extremely long periods of time. And basically that became a kind of new gospel or a new doctrine that took over and pretty much ruled the establishment. We've begun to understand in the last, say, 100 years, and 30 or 40 years certainly, that often changes occur very quickly, and as a consequence of catastrophic events. And that, Velikovsky, who is one of the prime authors of that idea, and but there are many others who also understand it now. In fact, it's become quite respectable, at least in certain terms, to realize that many of the changes that have become permanent occurred virtually overnight in a very quick period of time. Many of them are associated with catastrophic events on a large scale. And so that's basically the essence of it. And then you get to the amnesia part that I was talking about, that we simply found it difficult to remember these events because they are so painful.
Right.
In another article in the book by David Lewis, Evolution versus Creation, which is also intriguing to me, he talks about Genesis. Genesis telling us that God created the universe in 6 days, which is creationism. And then in 1859, Charles Darwin came up with his theory, evolution and natural selection. Lewis says, recent studies suggest both sides of this issue should reexamine their positions because they may be missing the mark entirely. I want you to tell us some of the evidence that exists which shows man neither evolved from apes nor rose from the dust of the earth 4,000 years before the time of Christ.
Well, I think there's plenty of evidence that we've been around, and one of the most important ideas that we're constantly developing in the magazine is this idea that that civilization has evolved to great heights in the past and then has been more or less utterly destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
For example, that's when you get into... The orthodox view of history is that civilization pretty much began about 5,000 years ago, and usually they identify the rise of civilization with the building of things like the pyramids and other things. But there's plenty of evidence that we were here long before that, and it had evolved to great heights long before that. One of the most significant, of course, is there are maps that show the existence of the coast of Antarctica underneath the ice, the way it actually, and they're accurate. And the thing is, Antarctica has been under the ice for thousands of years, probably 10,000 years. And showing that the ancients actually knew the precise, arrangement of the Antarctic coast is a revelation that they were highly developed. They understood geography. They understood all that goes along with it. They had developed a civilization to great heights. And we're talking pre-ice age,
mm-hmm.
or another way of putting that is pre-diluvian. So you start seeing the many ancient cultures describing events that came, you know, a long, much longer ago than Orthodox.
Doug, does Darwin account for the origin of consciousness with his theories?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that he explained many things. You know, how flowering plants evolved, or I guess you're getting to the intelligent design idea, and I think that that makes a lot of sense. I mean, certainly there were many systems in nature that are simply too complex and have qualities about them that cannot be understood as product of, you know, just straightforward evolution.
Right.
They require you to see the development of, you have to see design of some sort involved in the process. And that makes, you know, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, Doug, a lot of people might say if they look at this book, well, why don't I know about any of this stuff? And you bring up in this book something called a scientific filter, which leads to these various cover-ups. And the authors in this book basically are saying that scientists right now and the academic elite have become the new priests of our society, and they don't consider things like mythology and the ancient writings and so forth like that came from the Sumerians. So let everybody know how there is this filter that keeps certain information out of the public consciousness.
Well, I think basically you're looking at what has become essentially a political phenomenon, and I'm talking about the politics of science. You know, any scientist who stumbles across something that's anomalous or which is a challenge to the prevailing paradigm risks losing, you know, risks his career going down the tubes, you know, if he starts asserting something that's really controversial. One of our authors in the book, well, one of the people that we feature in the book, is Michael Cremo, who wrote a great book called Forbidden Archaeology.
Yep.
And a number of other related books. Michael and his colleague, who's Richard Thomas, did a lot of close examination of the actual literature that it, upon which Orthodox theory of origins is based, and they discovered, to their surprise, that there have been any number of studies, literally hundreds, that have produced evidence essentially irrefutable of, you know, backing the idea that, number one, that man has been around a lot longer here than is normally believed, that are challenges to Darwinian orthodoxy on many fronts. And that evidence is very, you know, it's very clearly presented. And Michael says that the reason there's a knowledge filter which operates, along, you know, these lines, and basically anything that comes along which upsets the orthodox belief systems is suppressed. They don't burn people at the stake anymore, but they can certainly, you know, put someone's career into a tailspin.
Uh-huh. Right.
by simply, you know, if you offend the wrong people.
And that happens all the time, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I would like to know why it would offend
you. The amnesia.
Why would it offend anyone?
Well, the thing is, people have a tremendous investment in the particular theory that they happen to believe in. You know, authority, the authority that scientists claim is based on the notion that they know something, that they are right about certain ideas, that they have, that therefore they become the arbiters of what is true and what isn't true. And that's where this idea of a priesthood gets involved.
Mm-hmm.
And they become the custodians of ultimate truth. And society entrusts them with this particular role. Of course, it contradicts the concept of science as it's originally defined and as we developed it, which is a quest for truth without regard to what conclusions it may arrive at. But in practice, you know, these ideas are simply, and it's so pervasive and it's so widespread that it's very difficult for anyone to challenge it, because
right.
people are kept in special, you know, they're involved in special. investigating Tutankhamun's underwear.
Yeah.
That's where their attention is. And people don't get the big picture.
Right. Yeah.
And
you
getting the big picture is extremely difficult. And because nobody has the authority, you know, to state, in other words, nobody's been entrusted with the big picture. It's just the system keeps everybody focusing on these little tiny areas of expertise.
Yeah. In fact, in your book, it's called, I believe, The Politics of Ideas. In your book, researcher J.B. Dallaire came upon many strange anomalies in his career, massive fossil records in bone caves where remains of incompatible prehistoric animals were washed up with human remains that were consistently dated to be around the same time period as these animals. Is the Ice Age an invention of geologists and the early scientific movement, as suggested in this book?
Well, I think that it can be argued that that's the case, because Ice Age theory is an idea, or it's offered essentially to explain how changes that were known to have occurred could have occurred without having the idea of a flood.
We're talking like 55 million years.
It's saying gradual. The Ice Age is the primary one of the principal theories of what can be called the school of gradualism, and the idea that it could have occurred much more quickly. Of course, Ice Age theory has a great deal of difficulty explaining many things. The caches of bones that you mentioned, other things, for example, the Siberian mammoths with buttercups, flowers still in their stomach, thousands of years later, indicating that they were quick frozen. That's very hard to understand, very hard to explain in the context of a completely gradual phenomenon, which is the Ice Age is supposed to have been.
Yeah. Well, Doug, you've mentioned a couple times now Emanuel Velikovsky. Almost anybody on the streets wouldn't know who this man is, but various authors in this book touch upon his research and talk about how important he is. And he wrote a book in 1950 called Worlds in Collision, and he was very derided at his time. But now, as time passes, he's taken more and more seriously. Tell everybody who Emanuel Velikovsky was.
Well, Velikovsky was a psychoanalyst by profession. I think I mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
He did a great deal of advanced scientific work. He was arguing pretty much in favor of a more literal interpretation of the Old Testament. He came up with he said, for example, that at one time Venus collided with the Earth, and that Venus was an asteroid or a comet that collided with the Earth and became the planet Venus. And he said a number of other things, many of which haven't been corroborated necessarily, but many of the things he said have been. Many of the things for which he was ridiculed at the time. One of the things he was really into was the idea of an electromagnetic universe, that there were electromagnetic forces at play between the various planets that really caused a lot of the ancient phenomena that we hear about, things like the thunderbolts of the gods, and other phenomena like this. But Velikovsky wrote a book the one that really impressed me was called Mankind in Amnesia. And was it Earth in Amnesia? Sorry, I'm having a senior moment, but it was one or the other. But it was this where he laid out this theory, and I read this back in the 60s, showing how we have essentially become a culture in amnesia. And a lot of the things that are associated with this, explain the popularity of certain ideas and the reason that we're directed to think in a certain way and not in other ways.
If this pre-cataclysmic civilization meant to pass down through time this message of human progress and harmony with the source of all creation, and if we're to take the position that recent prehistory was not at all what modern science has suggested and stated that it is or that it was, are we supposed to change the way we see our past, and how do we go about reversing this amnesia?
Well, it's not an easy answer to that question, because for one thing, it takes courage. One of the reasons why that certain records of our prior experience are blocked is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fear of the unknown and the fear of what we may discover. I think that usually in the analog of a personal experience where someone has, say, forgotten childhood memories and yet still as an adult they find themselves behaving compulsively in some particular way because of forgotten experience, and then they go through the process of psychoanalysis or what have you, and slowly they become aware of what it was they forgot, and as they reawaken the records of the painful experience, they end up having to re-experience it in some way, and that is frequently that in itself becomes very traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's kind of the challenge that's in front of us right now, and a lot of people shy away from that. But I think that it's not something we really have a choice about.
Yeah.
If we can understand that if we don't do it, what happens is that we essentially reenact the original experience, because this is the nature of this is the soul is driven to complete or to heal itself, or to try to pull the its past together in such a way that it can be whole, because that's what it seeks. It seeks wellness, and if it's frustrated in that, it'll reenact it.
Yeah, I think we're not only persuaded to forget, I think we're also persuaded to fear. And we always come back to this fear factor.
Yeah, and I think that we could progress so much further, because what we're doing is just reliving the same mistakes we made before, because we're not allowed to realize what those mistakes were. But Doug, I have one more question, but before I ask it, tell everybody again how they can find Forbidden History and also the website for Atlantis Rising, your magazine.
Well, Forbidden History is available in most, should be available in most major bookstores and most of the chains. Just ask for Forbidden History, and you can find it with my name, Kenyon, K-E-N-Y-O-N. And also, and as far as Atlantis Rising is concerned, that's also available on newsstands in most stores and most of the big chains anyway. And you can get to our website at AtlantisRising.com.
All right, very good.
And give you an opportunity to download a PDF of the current issue.
Exactly. Now, as the editor of this book, I have to say it was masterful the way you picked the final chapter by David Lewis. And there's a concept in there of the physicist as a mystic. And what he does is he writes about the interconnectedness of the universe. And I think in life today, everybody tries to segment things off or put everything in their little compartments, differentiated from everything else. But this author saying is, hey, this everything's together as a whole, huh? What are your final comments on that chapter?
Well, I think that that's exactly what we find out through all of our investigations, is that the separation that we thought was a reality, we discover that it's essentially an illusion. It's an illusion born out of a certain way of thinking, and it has to be, it has to be penetrated. We have to get to the truth of the matter, which is, it's all one.
Yeah. Well, Doug, as I said, it's the opening of this show. It's the best book I've read in the last 2 or 3 years. The title's Forbidden History, and you've just been absolutely intriguing with your explanations.
Do you think we're heading toward a paradigm shift in consciousness, Doug?
Oh, I think so. And you folks are very kind.
Well, Doug, thank you.
No, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I know you're busy with your magazine and so forth, but just thank you for putting this book together. Thanks for coming on Wing TV, and keep up the great work, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be back tomorrow on Wing TV.
Wow.
Until then, exactly. We could have stayed here for days talking about this book. But we'll be back tomorrow on Wing TV. Until then, keep your eyes open, because there's a lot going on.
See you all then.